Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is miracles of faith and will. Perhaps you might all be aware of that lovely story by Paul Gallicot, A Small Miracle. It's about a boy, a 10-year-old orphan boy called Papino, who lived in the town of Assisi. And he had a donkey, a female donkey called Violeta. Now, that donkey was his companion, friend, comfort, means of livelihood. And when this donkey falls ill, severely ill, so that the doctor says no hope for her, Papino was not going to give up so easily. He had heard that Saint Francis was a great lover of animals especially, but otherwise of the whole creation of God. So, and also he knew that his friend had taken his little kitten, smuggled inside the church of Saint Francis, and it was really made well. So, he was determined to take this Violeta to the tomb of Saint Francis. How to do it? And he was told that yes, he required permission. He approached the supervisor, and the author shows the kind of person the supervisor was. The bishop was present when the little boy approaches the supervisor, and while the boy is asking for permission with such faith that I know Saint Francis, once he sees my Violeta, he will be moved, you know, as if Saint Francis is present there, and he will cure her. Now, the bishop is happy that this supervisor, who is so commercially minded, should come face to face with this innocent fate. But the supervisor is more worried about getting somewhere the relic. He says, no, boy, this cannot be done. Your donkey cannot be taken inside the church. And he starts discussing, if only we could find the tooth of Saint Francis, a lock of hair, more tourists will come, we'll get more money. Of course, the boy is again not going to be outdone. So he says, who's the next that I can approach? And straight away, he is told, you can go and meet the Pope at Vatican. Now from Assisi, he travels to Vatican, gathers enough money, and again, how do you reach him? So he buys a bunch of flowers, writes a little note, gives it to the guard. But such was that intensity of faith that the guard, when he gets this bunch of flowers in his hands, he doesn't feel like throwing away, although that's what he wanted to do. And he passes it on to the clerk, and he to the next person in hierarchy, and on and on and on. The note with the bunch of flowers finally reaches the Pope. And he is called there. And the Pope grants him permission. And the author says, here itself a minor miracle was already worked, that an obscure little boy from a town is able to meet. Imagine in those days to meet Pope was so difficult, the highest authority as it were. He manages that, and not just that, he grants him the permission to go inside them. And then there is another problem. The donkey cannot go by the normal way. So the Pope grants the permission to break the wall, which was as it were hiding another entrance, which was a larger one. And what happens when they break the wall? Tumbles out a small box which contains the relics which the supervisor was looking for. The cord which was worn by Saint Francis around his waist, a little feather, a wilted, dried up flower. These are the things which he loved, and that is what was there in the box. But how does the story end? As it were, the author doesn't say that the bond donkey was cured and so his faith was rewarded. No. He just says that the boy and the donkey then, as the entrance was opened, they continued their pilgrimage of faith. Now this is really nice. It's not said that he was cured. They continued their pilgrimage of faith. And interestingly, in the middle of the story somewhere, when the boy is talking to a priest, the priest, who is very nice-minded, asks the boy, would you just go to Saint Francis only to ask something of him? Or would you be willing to give also if that is required? The boy understands the meaning. And so he is very tearful. He says, yes, I will. If I must, I will give also, but I hope Saint Francis will allow me to keep my Violeta a little longer. You see, this faith, this kind of faith and this kind of attitude of being willing to give also if that is what is required is important in true faith, as we shall see a little later, because there are times when, in spite of very, very what we call a strong faith, things don't really happen as you had expected. Then what is your attitude? What happens to your faith? That we shall see as we go along. Now, there are pilgrimages of faith like this in people's lives. Like, for instance, we think of Mother Teresa, who was once told when she came to India, I believe, that what will Mother Teresa do with 6 cents? She was having only 6 cents with her. And Mother Teresa's answer was, Mother Teresa and 6 cents can't do anything, but Mother Teresa with 6 cents and with God can do everything. Here again, this is a woman who has absolutely no idea what she is going to do, but with the faith in God and with 6 cents, she starts on that pilgrimage of faith. And we know what wonderful job, what wonderful work she did in India. Now, also, just before we get into the very deep subject of faith, miracle, will, another story which we are all familiar with comes to our mind about a man, or rather, I think a young disciple who had to go across a river. But there was a bridge which was so narrow that he was afraid to cross. So he tells his guru that, I'm afraid I might just fall down into the river, so won't you just come with me? And the guru says, of course you can cross the river. I don't think it is so difficult, but if you say so, I'm there behind you. Just go right ahead. And now he's filled with confidence. So he walks on that narrow ledge, goes across to the other shore, and when he turns to look, he finds the guru standing at the other end only. He was not there. And yet, those words filled him with so much faith that he could cross over something which he thought was impossible for him. Now, these are remarkable things. These are wonderful things for which we use the word miracle. We say that miraculous things happen. These wonderful things, if we call them as miracle, then Light on the Path somewhere says that when a child is able to focus his eyes and conquers his eyesight, making it obedient to the brain, the scientist knows that already a miracle is worked out, because it's no easy thing for a child to focus his eyes and begin to see. And similarly, as he uses one by one each of his senses, a minor miracle is created. So in a way, as Walt Whitman says, we are surrounded by miracles every day all around us, if this is what we call as miracle. But also we use the word miracle not for something remarkable and wonderful, but for something which is unfamiliar. Something which is strange, which you can't really explain, no rational explanation is possible. And then you say, oh, it's really the work of devil or a work of God. And that's what the church used to do. We are told that both Catholic and the Protestant church would ascribe all these miraculous phenomena of walking over water, walking over fire, things like healing the sick and raising the dead. All that, they said, it could be done by only their chosen ministers, or it could be done only by their holy saints, with the help either of the angels or with the direct intervention of God. But when someone outside of church did it, it was the work of devil. Now we are told that as it happened in the last part of 19th century, at every nook and corner you found spiritualists, mediums, you found mesmerists. They could do everything which the fathers used to do, the holy saints used to do, raising the dead, healing the sick, all those things. And now, of course, the church had no defense. Its position was really weakened, because here were ordinary people doing apparently miraculous things. So, theosophy would say that, in fact, there is no miracle. That's what our first reading says. There is no miracle. Everything that happens is the result of law. Eternal, immutable, ever active, apparent miracle is but the operation of forces antagonistic to the well-ascertained laws of nature. There may be laws once known, now unknown to science. And what comes to our mind is the well-known example we always give of levitation. If someone lifts him up in the air like a bird, you are wonderstruck. It is really a miracle. But is it really a miracle? And well, theosophy will explain by saying that The person who lifts himself up in the air is not defying gravity. He is not breaking the law of gravitational attraction. Because the earth itself is a magnet which is positively charged. All the bodies on earth are negatively charged and so they remain attracted to earth. But the moment a person is able to, either through his strong will, through mantram, through any breathing exercise, through any other way, if he is able to change somehow the polarity of his body and make it positive, then you know that the positive, or rather the two like poles, will repel. And so the body is lifted up in the air like a bird. So this is all there is to the miracle of levitation. So HPP says that what science knows is half the law, which is attraction. The other half is repulsion. And that is why we say, there is a little booklet called Textbook for Theosophical Meeting. In it you will find 10 propositions of Oriental psychology. And they talk about what you should know if you want to understand the miraculous phenomena or really perform miraculous phenomena. First thing you must grasp is that behind the physical nature and physical man, there is a whole of astral realm having its own laws. There is a spiritual realm likewise having its own laws, like your physical world has its laws. More than that, you must have knowledge of the occult psychology, occult physiology, occult chemistry, knowledge of electricity and magnetism and their effect on animal kingdom, human kingdom, and above all, a perfected human will combined with imagination and faith. Now what is this perfected human will? Even before we see the miracles of will as it were, it's very important for us to know what is will. And we say that will is the force of spirit in action. It's a colorless force. Force of spirit in action. Spirit is everywhere. The divine essence is everywhere. So will also is everywhere. In fact, at one place in Isis and Vale, HPB says that these manifestations of attraction and repulsion, they are but the action of will. So, for instance, she gives the example that when a serpent fascinates or charms a little bird before killing it, it is in a way the unconscious action or unconscious exercise of the will by that serpent in that particular act. Similarly, conscious exercise of will in that fascination. Similarly, she says that when you rub a glass rod or the amber rod, you rub it. Science says that there is a kind of a heat awakened in that body. And if you hold it near pieces of paper, they will get attracted to the glass rod. Now this again, the occultist will say this is unconscious action of will. The very attraction of the pieces of paper to the glass or the amber rod is unconscious action of will. And similarly, in the very human body, we are told that the heartbeat, the circulation of blood, digestive system, that the way it works, all these voluntary automatic actions are action of will. But when you come to human level, will is more developed. In fact, we experience will at two levels. There is a personal will. People we brand as a strong will man, someone who is very stubborn, we say, really strong-willed. Is he really strong-willed? No. It is a personal will at work where we might even say he is in a way a weak-willed person because it is the strong desire which is at work. Behind will stands desire. So when you have an intense desire to make money, you have an intense desire to get promotion, even to make or build an athletic body or a slim body, whatever may be the desire, the strong desire will move the will into action and then your work is done and you get your goal, reach your goal, and we say it's the strong will and determination. But it is really the personal will which is at work. And that's what we find. Even when you have a certain person who the doctor might say he is not going to live for more than 12 hours. But if there is a strong desire to see the face of a son, maybe who is in America and is yet to come, get the daughter married, there is what we call as jijivisha, the desire to live. And that will to live, the desire to live, will make him hang on and on. Quite contrary to the prediction of the doctor. And so it is again the lower kind of will, wherein because of the intense desire you carry on and you are not going to, the soul doesn't leave the body though the doctor may have predicted. Now personal will is one thing, and we are told that there is something called as spiritual will. In fact, even the will which is developed by yoga practices, something which is developed by fasting, by torturing of the body, you may look at him and feel that what a strong will he has. Even that is personal will, strong as it may be. Spiritual will is an altogether a different thing. When we are talking about a perfected human will, we are talking about spiritual will. And to that we are told that spiritual will can come only when your desires are purified. One by one, in fact there is a pamphlet 7 in which Ormus and Ahriman, the last section is called the desire made pure. And we are told that one by one you have to purify your desire. First your desire for wealth and material things, then your desire for power, fame, name, and even your desire to love and to be loved, even that must go. All that remains is only one desire, and that is to have union with the divine. Now it's a long way to go, we can see that. And Mr. Judge, in the preface to Patanjali's Yoga Aphorism, says that Patanjali doesn't mention will explicitly anywhere in his aphorisms, and yet it's implicitly there everywhere. And that is the will, the divine will, the spiritual will, which comes about when you have completely pure desire, which is only to achieve union with the divine, nothing else. So purification of desire is important, and that is why Mr. Crosby says that the force of will, it's like sunlight. If you put a big cardboard against a window, no light can come. Make a small hole, depending upon the size of the hole, that much light can come in. But what we have done? Like the sunlight, the force of the will is illimitable and exhaustless, because it is the force of spirit. But we have reduced it to pinholes of petty, small, mean, selfish desires. Our desires are not noble. Our desires are small. We want things for ourselves. So that great power of will, the force of will, cannot really come into action at all. And secondly, another thing that he points out is that you must have noble, universal ideas, because ideas give direction to the will. And what ideas, what thoughts do we have that our great force of will can be directed? At one other place, he gives another kind of injunction for development of spiritual will. And he points out that cultivate complete unselfishness. Live the life wherein you are ready to listen to the voice of your conscience, behest of your spiritual nature within. You must be willing to go through all which your higher nature has in store for you by way of experience and discipline. And here we murmur. If there is problems, we begin to say, what did I do to deserve this? But if you are able to go through any and every experience which is brought to you under karma, saying that it is what I in fact deserve and desired, then that hold of the lower nature over the higher is relaxed. And in fact, at one place he tells us that in little things of life you will see how your personal nature is so assertive. So he gives one example that if on a Sunday afternoon you have decided that you will read philosophy, or you will read theosophy, or maybe Shakespeare, you love to do it. And just then a very boring person walks in. Now all that you are required to, or you must do, is drop what you are reading, attend to him. You don't want to do it because you don't like to disturb your plan. You don't want to attend to him because you don't like to get bored by boring people. He says both these are personal considerations. Your likes and dislikes you should be able to set aside and pay attention to his interest. When you can do this in the little things of life, you will find that then the personal is getting paralyzed and the divine will find really the expression. So the more we listen, and pay heed to the conscience, the greater is the development of will, and the entire attitude must be, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In the prayer or otherwise, we may do some work and might appear to be saying that, now it's all God's will, I don't know, I have done my best. But then you are so anxious about the result that you are not really saying, thy will be done. But if you really acquire that attitude, what happens? HPB says that then you are in a position when your wishes, your desires, your prayer becomes a will prayer. It is not a petitionary prayer any longer where you are just requesting and asking God. It's a will prayer. It's a mental utterance where you wish for something and that thing just happens. It's not a prayer, it's a command. It just happens. So this will prayer just happens because your very wish, that very prayer, that mental utterance, it becomes like a philosopher's stone, converts your finite desire and makes it available or kind of assimilable to the divine in you. We are getting into all this because let's understand what a perfected human will is all about. Because we are always mistaking the personal strong will for spiritual will. So that will, that faith which we are talking about is both spiritual faith and spiritual will. Not the ordinary kind of faith or ordinary kind of will. Now talking about this will, perfected human will, HPB has given several examples and time is not enough to really get into so many apparently miraculous happenings which become possible with will. First of all, she says that all human beings, they give out some magnetic emanations from their bodies. We all give out unconsciously. But some people like a mesmerist, a hypnotizer, can use his strong will to direct this magnetic fluid which is thrown out. So with his strong, determined will, he can project the magnetic fluid of his body onto another person. And well, the person is mesmerized, hypnotized, put into trance. He can be healed. He can be helped. He can be given some commands and he will follow it. All these things happen because of the strong will. Similarly, she says that with the strong will directing the magnetic fluid of the body of the person, you can imbue an inert object and it can be endowed with a destructive or a protective power. Now this is whole rationale of what is called as talisman or amulet. What happens when a Baba or a Swami gives an amulet or a talisman to another? What does he do? HPB says that if there is a strong-willed person and if he holds a needle into his hand, in a little while the needle will get magnetized. Like you have a little piece of iron kept near a very powerful magnet, it will get magnetized by induction. So also this needle, so also any object can get magnetized. Magnetized in what way? It's not just the magnetism which is thrown with the will, but also his motive, his thoughts, his feelings are also going along with that fluid which is passed on to the object. And therefore, if he has charged the object with a positive vibrations, thoughts, feelings, with the intention to do good, then that particular, it could be a little stone, it could be a little piece of metal, it could be simply a paper or a handkerchief. Baba will say, take this thread, he will hold and then give it to you. You will be protected. And sure enough, you are protected. But similarly, we are told that if someone holds the object like that, but with the intention of harm, even such things are heard that someone picks up the pen innocently and he comes to harm. Because that is the thing which is charged with a kind of a bad, kind of negative will and magnetism. This is also the whole rationale behind what is called as Jetatara or the evil eye. Unconsciously, some of us possess evil eye. And what is it? It's just this, that you have a will which works consciously or unconsciously, and you have envy or hatred for another. If someone has a new, brand new car, you want to buy it too. You can't afford it. How can he have when I don't have a car? and therefore you look with envy on the car, probably what is happening is from your eyes the magnetic fluid flows, carries with it the evil intention. You don't want him to have the car. So the car, he meets with accident in the car, there is a dent in the car, any of these things. Sometimes little children, somebody is not having any children and looks upon the child and really craves for having a child, or enviously looks at the child, a healthy baby. And so we say, nazar utarna padega. You know, there is an evil eye, as it were, because the child will cry and cry all the time. So all this is what? It is magnetism. Backed by will, backed by good or evil thought. And that is why HPB says, don't think you don't have these things. Don't think that some Baba or Swami only has it. Because she goes on to say here. See, I think fourth quotation in the first page. Every man or woman is endowed more or less with a magnetic potentiality, which when helped by a sincere and especially by an intense and indomitable will, is the most effective of magic levers placed by nature in human hands for weal, for woe as for weal. And therefore, in fact, she goes on to say that when you send New Year greetings to someone, you may innocently write and send a greeting, but you don't know that with that piece of paper, you are sending your very inner emotions and your inner intention. So she says, be careful when you are sending this greeting, especially to your enemies, people you don't like. Try and feel especially friendly and forgiving towards them before you send the greeting, lest you end up sending evil-eye greeting to them. Instead of something good happening, something bad will happen when they receive your greeting. So something small as that. And on the other hand, we know you can really bless people. When the elderly people raise their hand like that, all that magnetism flows from the toes of the feet, from the hands. And with that goes their very good, potent good wishes, which are for you. That's blessing. And we are all capable of doing that. It's not as if, as we said, a particular person can do it. No. If we have goodwill, as they say, we can do it. We have the power of will in that sense. HPB also narrates, especially for the people who are a little developed, she gives example of a fakir in Isis and Vail called Chip Chandar, and almost, well, miraculous things he does, simply sitting at where the spot. At the end of all the kind of phenomena, HPB asked him, how do you manage this? And he says, simply will, that's all. And what was done? There were around 12 snakes, deadly poisonous snakes, which were in front of him. With one wave of his hand, all of them are put in a paralytic state. Again, the same rationale as we said, the will sending out the fluid in the direction, paralyzing the bodies. He waves a hand to the light in a distant house, and the light becomes dimmer, dimmer, dimmer till it is extinguished. He waves a hand and the furniture moves from here to there, there to there. He waves a hand and the windows and the doors begin to open and close. We know how HPB herself, when she was still a young girl, and she challenged her brother that there is this little stool, just lift it up. The brother said, what? You are telling me to lift up a stool as if I can't do it. And he begins to do it with both his hands. The whole of the family members try to do it. They just can't budge the stool. Simple manifestation will. That is all. And she just laughed. HPB was HPB. And so many others are there. Time will not permit. We are not here just to discuss the phenomena. The idea is to understand that such things happen. Human will is capable of so many things. Now, will, of course, is always combined with faith. And that is why there are these two reasons. Paracelsus adds, faith must confirm the imagination, for faith establishes the will. Determined will is the beginning of all magical operations. The last one says, the words, whosoever shall say to this mountain, be thou removed and cast into the sea, and shall not doubt, that thing will come to pass, are no vain words. Only the word faith ought to be translated by will. Faith without will is like a windmill without wind, barren of results. So, faith must have will, and will must have faith. In fact, both are
very synonymous and complementary to each other. Now, what is faith? And again, let's see on the second page the first definition. It is from Light on the Path. It says, faith is a great engine, an enormous power, which in fact can accomplish all things, for it is a covenant or engagement between man's divine power and his lesser self. It's an agreement between the man's lower and higher natures, like an agreement between a parent and a child, which is based on trust. The parent will not do anything to break the trust of the child, and the child knows that in spite of the fact that the parents sometimes scold him, reprimand him, don't give him what he wants, but the parents mean well. All that has been done to him is for his own good and growth. So this is the kind of agreement which should be there between the lower and the higher nature. The lower nature, the personal man must know that even when the higher is leading him into loneliness, into difficulties, into painful experiences, he's being led into these because he has to learn something and grow. And therefore, when in spite of these calamities, the faith is kept firm, that is the true faith. That is the true faith. The faith in the law of karma and the faith in the divine nature within. In fact, that is sattvic faith. All the other may be classed as rajasic or tamasic faith. Now, about this sattvic faith, therefore, HPB has to say in her first article in Raja Yoga, one of the requirements of a true disciple is that he should have an unswerving faith in the law of karma, independent of any power in nature that could interfere. A law whose course is not to be obstructed by any agency, not to be caused to deviate by prayer or propitiatory exoteric ceremony. What do? When karma brings us something, somebody who is saying all the time, I have firm faith in the law of karma, I have firm faith in God, what happens when there is a loss? Financial loss, loss of a loved one, loss of reputation. Immediately you run to a nearby temple, you want to perform a ceremony, you want to do something so that everything should be made right. Where is our faith? Faith in the law. This is what the disciple is told, that he will not cause the law of karma to deviate from its path by any propitiatory ceremony or ritual or anything of that sort. And that is why, very rightly, Professor C.S. Lewis gives the example that he's a Christian writer who says that sometimes when you are, you know, you talk about faith, but it is really not strong enough until it is tried, as it were. It is only a verbal notion, firm faith, firm belief. It's really not firm enough. So he gives the example of a person. He says that you show him a thick rope and tell him that there is a huge box which is going to be tied with this rope, and it is going to be hung at the by the edge of the precipice. Do you think it is strong enough? Do you think the rope will hold the weight and not break? And he might casually look and say, oh yeah, I think, I believe it will hold. Don't you worry, you can go ahead. Now tell him next that this rope which you find so strong and firm, you have to tie around your waist and you will be hung by the edge of the precipice. And then watch. He will begin to waver. All that firm faith he had in the strength of the rope will waver. He will say, I'm not too sure, I don't think it is strong enough. Because now it's a question of his life. This, he says, is how our faith in God and law is. When life is going smoothly, we all say, I have firm faith in my Krishna, I have firm faith in my Jesus. But we know of people who, after loss of loved ones, turned complete atheist. They who are doing puja two times a day would not just go near the God. Is this real faith? Faith is such, it should become stronger and stronger as it is tried. It's easy to say, difficult to do, but that is what is true faith. Not the faith in something which is external. Now, talking about faith, before we come to something more, talking about faith, as the first speaker mentioned, immediately what comes to our mind are the miracles, as it were, of faith cures. There are lots of faith cures, as it were, happening, and we have in our life heard at least one or two of them. And HPB also narrates one or two examples of faith cures where Sir Humphrey Davy, it seems, was going to operate on a paralytic patient. Now, before the operation, he thought it will be better to take his temperature. So he put thermometer beneath the tongue of this patient, and the patient was completely illiterate. He didn't know what is what. So when the thermometer was put, he thought the treatment has begun. So he was very enthusiastic. Said, "Doctor, I think I'm already feeling a little better." When Sir Humphrey Davy heard that, he thought, there's something here. So after a few hours, once again he put the thermometer beneath his tongue and postponed the operation. He continued doing it day after day at a regular interval. And what did he find? He found the patient was cured of his paralysis even without any operation or anything. And the second example he gives is about a lady who was having a regular, as we call as a family doctor. But when she was suffering from a dire dysentery, the family doctor was away. Now, that was the regular doctor. And of course, but the assistant was equally competent. So he gives some medicine to her. She begins to take completely right course of action. 3 days, 4 days, she deteriorates. And finally, she's on the verge of dying. Nothing works. Right medicine, everything fine. The doctor comes back. And he understands that, of course, he has done the correct, given the correct treatment. But I might as well go and see her because she's such an old patient of mine. So he goes to meet her. As soon as he is inside the room, the patient says, "I knew I'll begin to recover as soon as you start the treatment. I have such confidence in you, doctor. Why don't you stay here in my house for 3-4 days? And he stayed on. And he says, "I did not give her any medicine. I was just there with her." And again, the woman was completely cured, taking walk with the doctor in the garden at the end of the 4th day. And HPP says, while her faith cured, the doctor lost his faith in medicine. And he gave up allopathic practice. I mean, this is what HPP is writing. Now, this is how it is. Faith. Faith, but as we say, faith in anything will bring results. Mr. Crosby says, faith in anything will bring results. And faith in something external is not really the right faith. It is a tamasic faith. You have faith in a religious faith. You have faith in a system of knowledge, certain dogmas. If you believe in the blood of Christ, your sins are washed off. And you have faith in all sorts of things. And even HPP again was told that there is a certain saint, I think Saint Francis Xavier, and his dead body, his corpse is kept there at Goa. And she was told that whenever that corpse is exposed to the public, hundreds of miracles are worked out. So HPP says, actually, with all reverence to St. Francis, it could have been anybody's dead body, you see. Because there are so many relics all over the world, and everywhere these miracles are worked out. She gives the example that at some place, I think in Ceylon or Japan, a tooth of Buddha is kept somewhere. Backbone of Confucius has been preserved and kept, and she says humorously that it could be the tail of a monkey or a boot worn by Colonel Ingersoll. Don't know who Colonel Ingersoll was, but it could be a boot worn by Colonel Ingersoll. Anything will do, because we don't believe in the relic. We believe in the mysterious power of faith. That is the whole thing. It's the faith of the people, not really that it is this or that or the other. But it is the faith. And that's what is there in our reading in the second page. That if there be in the patient alone a faith supreme and unshakable in the power of a healer, of a holy relic, of the touch of a shrine, of the waters of a well, of a pilgrimage to a certain place and a bath in some sacred river, of any given ceremonies or repetitions of charms or an amulet worn about the neck, in either of these or many more agencies that might be named, then the patient will cure himself by the sole power of his predisposed faith. And that's what the last one also says. With expectancy supplemented by faith, one can cure himself of almost any morbific condition. In thousands of instances, the doctor, the priest, or the relic has had the credit of healings that were solely and simply due to the patient's unconscious will. Will and faith. As we know about Jesus also, that a woman touched his garment. And one thing that he said was, "Who touched me? I felt virtue in me." But he also told, I think in another instance, that your faith has made thee whole. I have not done anything. It's your faith that if I touch Jesus, I will be cured, and that has made you whole. So, this is faith. But we are told that faith in anything external is not the highest faith. And that's something we have to keep in mind. And we have to keep in mind that first exhaust all the worldly, finite, temporal means before you can really use otherworldly means of curing yourself or achieving your goal, because this is what the world seems to be doing now. In fact, again, at one place Mr. Judd says that it would be very foolish if a man had a fractured leg or a brain tumor or a stomach indigestion, and if he sits and says, "Don't please call the doctor, I am going to now close my eyes and exercise my will or exercise my thoughts or kind of send a petition to my favorite God and my faith, my will, my thoughts is going to cure." Foolish. He says he should undergo surgery. He should take the medicine. That is the temporal thing for which the temporal means must be employed. And we don't have to really resort to any kind of otherworldly means for that. It's like ragging down something from a higher plane. Even if the psychic powers are used, leave alone the spiritual powers. And we find it happening even these days. How is it that this world, so many, especially fake Baba, Swami, Sadhus, they thrive so much? Why is it? What are they thriving on? They are thriving on our psyche, our mentality of getting a quick solution. Any little problem and you run to Baba? What for? You work for it. You work for your problem and it will get a solution. So in fact, I think a year back or so, there was a very wonderful article in Times of India saying that there are these Babas and Swamis, each one is a specialist in his field. So if you don't get a bank loan, you go to a certain Baba. If you are having a marriage problem, this is the expert in the field. If you want a break in the film, go to a certain Baba. An assignment you want in modeling, this Baba will do. And so on and on. For trifling things which are completely personal, you will go and ask a Baba, who could be fake, but who could be true also. And he will exercise on your behalf some power so that you can get a bank loan or you can get a break in the film. What for? And when it happens, your faith in the Baba is established. So if the Baba also preaches some teachings along with these miracles, you will take his teachings as gospel truth. How can you question? It is this and this Baba who has said. So actually you are surrendering your very reasoning and intuition to this person, because it is blind faith. And that's how you have hundreds of people simply blindly following a person. It is blind leading the blind. Not all of them are of that such a high stature wherein you can really surrender your very reason to him and start following. So is it really worthwhile? This is the whole thing which we have to keep in mind. I think we would leave some 5 to 7 minutes for asking questions. When shall we know that we have to stop the worldly treatment?
Whatever worldly means to cure.
Worldly means to cure. And start
believing in faith and will.
And start believing in faith and will. Well, one has to try whatever is around him. Like if you are in a village, there are very limited means of worldly treatment, right? Because in the village you may not even have a good doctor or a hospital. You may, if you have means, take the person to the nearby city, as it were, and get his treatment. You know how from villages there are cancer patients coming to Tata and get the treatment. But when you don't have any means, you know, that is the whole thing. You have to explore whatever is before you. Whatever doctors you know, you explore all the possibilities. One doctor, maybe the next doctor, if your means are really there that much, point in time you feel that, okay, I have done my very best to try out this or that or the homeopathy, allopathy, Ayurvedic, nothing has worked. You can then leave it as it were. Leave it to nature, as they say. Leave it to nature what course it will take. And in that, if you add your faith, actually leaving it to nature is a kind of faith, you know, that whatever comes under the natural law, I am willing to accept. So now you are exercising your faith in doing that. It is not really faith in any Baba or a Swami, or consulting a Baba or a Swami, which also people do. And there is not a hard and fast or cut and dried line. People are today even going to hypnotizers. And what does theosophy would, what would theosophy say? Well, in hypnotism, once you go, the danger is that you are surrendering your will to the hypnotizer. He is actually operating on your will also. You are surrendering your will, and therefore, for the lifetime, you are under his, as it were, guidance. Anytime he wants you to do something, you would do it. And she gives in the past examples where a hypnotizer can put an idea into your mind to go and kind of commit a crime, a murder, do something which you otherwise in your normal state would not do. So this is the danger. And yet, what do we find today? We find people going to hypnotizers. In certain of the diseases, people go to what they call as the past life recall therapists, where they will put you under a hypnotic sleep and they will take you to your past lives. And yes, there are cures. So we know of a case which was reported that a certain person was very, very afraid of water. There was a morbid phobia about water, and she was put under a hypnotic trance, past life regress, and she could find that in a certain life, something had happened wherein she was pushed into water by someone, and from because of that, she was carrying the phobia in this life. Once that experience was gone through of recalling the past, she was cured. Now, what would you say? Well, theosophy will not dictate and say that go or don't go to a hypnotist. Your pain is relieved, but it is left to you. Are you ready to also take this danger into account? That therefore you are going to surrender your will. Not all hypnotists will be bad, but you are doing that. You can go to a mesmerist if you can find one, a good mesmerizer. You can go to a metaphysical healer. You can go to any of these alternative therapies which are there. But what do you understand of that alternative therapies? Because you are stepping into a realm which is an invisible realm. If the damage is done on the physical plane, you can put it right by taking another medicine. But if the damage is done at a psychic level, do we really know how to put that right? We don't. Sometimes in the cures we are told that the cure is done, it is only temporary. It is not a permanent cure. So that what you have done is actually sent back the causes of the disease back to the mind. And so at some other time, that disease will begin to once again manifest after maybe few years or so. So these are the things which theosophy just shows and leaves it to an individual. It is up to you to really get into this kind of a thing wherein you make use of these powers of someone else curing you, someone else curing you through his will, through hypnotism, through mesmerism. It's up to you to decide. But first, at least try and exhaust all the means. That judgment is the individual's judgment. How far is he going to go? People go to hypnotizers to cure themselves of habits. So many stars in USA, they go to these hypnotists to be cured of their smoking habit, alcoholism. Now, do you need to undergo hypnotism for? Or should you not assert your will? It's a question of your powerful will so that you can say, this is the last cigarette, no more smoking. If you don't do that, HPB says, yes, in this life you can be cured of the habit. But in some life, you will have to learn to deal with it yourself. Hypnotizer is vicariously doing it for you. You, when will you learn? There is no merit in overcoming the habit if hypnotizer is going to do. So this is the crux of the thing. You have to apply your faith and your will for overcoming whatever is there. Now,
how people are afraid of that evil eye.
Yeah.
So how they have to react?
People need not
afraid of that.
Correct. Theosophy's answer is very, very simple. You are afraid of evil eye, you are afraid of black magic. That movie Inception had come where it is said that somebody can really bend your will during sleep, and then when you wake up, you will do as that person desires. All these things are there, and HPV's answer is simple. That if you live a fairly pure life, as an averagely good man, having full of goodwill towards all who are around you, and then always the desire to help others, you are already protected. So, when there is this desire to help others and a pure life that works as a shield or a protection, you don't require any amulet, any taweez, nothing from anybody. Otherwise, you would find every day in the papers, every alternate person becoming victim of evil eye. It doesn't happen. And after all, if you go a little more into evil eye, what is it? In a way, we are told that it is a quick precipitation of karma. It is a quick precipitation of your karma. Why not anybody else and you became the target of evil eye? Because you and that person karmically were sharing something in which your bad karma, which would have otherwise gone on for maybe spread over three lives, it's now quickly precipitated in one life. And you have a kind of a, like a boulder that karma comes to you. Through his evil eye, he has become a karmic agent. And through his evil eye, you are experiencing the karmic backlash. So let us not think that evil eye is outside of karma. Unconscious or conscious evil eye is very much within the realm of karma. And not everyone is affected by evil eye. Because some of us might be having evil eye and we are not aware. You know, you get jealous, so intensely jealous of another. And maybe sometimes the another is affected and we don't even know that we have this evil eye. So, but another is protected if his karma will permit and if his purity will permit. So we need not be afraid of the evil eye, provided we are fairly pure and having generally good of others at our heart. This is what Theosophy says. Our time is up.